This podcast is supported by The RealReal. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The RealReal.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces. Gucci bags, Prada heels. But my style keeps evolving. Selling with The RealReal? Game changer. I earn more and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell fast to our 38 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The RealReal than anywhere else.
Exactly. This? That's the sound of your closet working for you. The RealReal. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And right now, you can get an extra $100 site credit when you sell for the first time. Go to TheRealReal.com to get your extra $100. TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com.
What you locked up for?
They count murder.
Did you kill him?
Sure I did.
Why?
Just one there tonight.
It's Tuesday, and you're listening to Murder Unscripted.
My name's Ed. For the past two decades, I've been producing true crime content for some of your favorite networks like Hulu, Oxygen, and of course, Investigation Discovery.
And I'm Melissa, Ed's bestie and walking, talking true crime database.
We've combined my behind-the-scenes insight with Melissa's morbid curiosity to bring you a podcast that immerses you in the true crime genre like never before.
We highlight victims' cases and bring you exclusive insight from the people who lived through them, with a touch of humor to lighten even the darkest stories.
This is Murder Unscripted.
Dun dun dun.
What is up, crime crew? Merry Christmas. Welcome to episode 83 of Murder Unscripted, podcast that breaks down the wall between true crime fan and true crime creator. I'm Ed Hydock here with a woman who's been on the naughty list since 1987, Melissa Spivey.
That is fair.
Unless we are in week four of December, and for those new to the show, this is our month to throw it back to the 2025 block of our choosing because it is our show and we will do as we damn well please.
Yeah.
Actually, throwback may be a good theme name. We always talk about how yearly recap sucks.
Yeah, that would work, except that this year ended up being like Serial Killers 2.0.
It did.
But at least it was at the beginning of the year, so it kind of bookends it. Because in January, we covered Ted Bundy and John Wayne Gacy. Mm-hmm. And then in the beginning of this month, I told you about that demon monster from hell, Anthony Allen Shore.
And I'm still pissed at you for sure, by the way. Like, been way happier not knowing about him and all the like disgusting things that he did.
If I had to know about it, you have to know about it.
That's nice. Well, while we're on the subject of demons from hell, we are knee deep in a discussion about the life and crimes of Richard Speck. And last week, we talked mostly kind of all about Richard. And I know that's not something we like to do. We are not promoting killers by any means, but I think it's important that you guys understand a little bit of how we got to the point where we are today. So we'd covered his early childhood, the death of his father, Benjamin, that monster that his mom ended up remarrying, that Carl Lindbergh guy. Mm-hmm. And we also talked about his child bride, Shirley, who she ended up giving birth to Richard's child, but she never got to meet her dad, which I think is for her good in the long run.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, we also talked about how Richard had a very complicated relationship in general with women, especially his mother. And I think it's critical to get an understanding of what was happening to Richard Speck's kind of warped brain in regards to his theory that women fell into two categories. Remember, Madonna and whore. There was really no gray areas, black and white. So if you guys haven't checked out part one, highly recommend you do that because we dove into a lot of interesting things. There was a lot to dissect, a lot to talk about. But also, part two may be kind of confusing if you didn't listen to part one, as a general rule in life.
It's true. Oh, and you know what? One more other reminder. The majority of our research comes from the book, The Townhouse Massacre by Ryan Green, which you can get on Amazon and probably every other bookstore.
I would think so. Yeah. Yeah, and that is important because there are different versions of information that are out there. So we went with the book just because we liked it. It was a good read. Well, when we left off, it was April 13th, 1966, and Richard had just killed bartender Mary Kay Pierce and left her to die in that pig pen that was out behind Frank's bar in Monmouth, Illinois. It was the one that he built himself.
Mm-hmm.
And about a week prior to the murder, he had actually attacked and sexually assaulted an older woman in her home. Remember Virgil Harris?
Yeah, I feel like you can see that he's escalating.
Right.
You know, he starts with random bar fights. Then he attacks and rapes a woman. Now he's killed a woman, or I'm sorry, allegedly killed a woman.
Yes, allegedly. Because technically no one has ever been charged with Mary's murder, but I think we know who did it.
Mm-hmm.
So in that pig pen, when Mary Pierce is succumbing to her injuries, Richard suddenly has this brief moment of clarity. And not only does he realize the scope of what he had done, but he also realized that they weren't terribly far from that bar, Frank's bar. And now the pigs in this pen were going bananas. Right? Because they were obviously alarmed by all the noise and commotion. And Richard's angry rage was replaced with this kind of overwhelming paranoia. He took off toward the room that he was renting at a place called the Christie Hotel. And that was one of those kind of like no-tell motels that turned a blind eye to everything, that as long as you paid for your room, like what happens in your room stays in your room.
Oh, I know a few. It's fine.
Are they hourly? Yeah.
Just kidding.
Well, by the next morning, everyone in Monmouth knew about Mary Pierce's murder. So not only was she well-known and well-liked in the community, but remember, her brother-in-law, Frank, was the guy who owned the barn, or the bar. And police quickly learned that Richard had not only been at the bar that night, but he'd actually been the one to build this pen where she was found. And obviously that isn't a smoking gun, but they still wanted to have a chat with Richard. And when they talked to him, he denied knowing anything about the murder. And after a few more questions, police told him basically, like, we don't really have anything hard to hold you on, but don't leave town. We got our eyes on you. So after a few more days of conducting interviews with people in the area, bar patrons that were there the night of the murder, police had this really creeping feeling about Richard. Because his versions of the events weren't exactly lining up with everybody else's version of the events. But when police go to the hotel to have another chat with him, he's gone. He picked up and took off. And when police checked with the front desk, the clerk said that Richard had left with a suitcase saying he was just heading to the laundromat, but in reality, he had picked up his belongings and just hightailed it out of town. But he did leave behind a few items, and most notably, it was the radio and some jewelry that belonged to Virgil Harris, the woman he assaulted. And there was also a bunch of other just kind of random odds and ends that had gone missing from local residents in the past few weeks, which is essentially how police connected Richard Speck to Virgil Harris's attack in the long run.
Yeah, he just left everything behind. Like, why did you bother to steal it?
He's not a brilliant criminal by any means.
No.
Well, and at the time, police didn't know that Richard had hopped aboard a train, destination Chicago. So once he arrived, he went straight to his sister Martha's house. And remember, Martha is Richard's older sister, and she lived with her husband Gene and their daughters. Martha had always been kind of a surrogate mother to Richard, but at this point, her patience had worn so thin with him. And then Gene, on the other hand, had zero patience for Richard. Remember, he was the guy that didn't even want him there the first time when he shows up on his couch, let alone the second time. He knew his brother-in-law was a no-good degenerate, basically a leech on his family and society as a whole, if we're being honest.
Fair, definitely. Yeah.
So Martha and Gene, they reluctantly take Richard in, but they make one thing very clear. This is a short-term solution. You are not living here.
Oh my goodness. He just like, you can't get rid of him.
No. One morning, Richard had been there just shy of a week, and Gene woke him up and basically said, get your ass out of bed, we'll find a job. Because it was abundantly clear, like this loser brother-in-law of his was not going to take the initiative to find a job on his own, so he needed some coaxing from Gene. And Gene had been in the Navy, so first of all, there you know he's a hard ass.
Yeah.
He's gonna ride this guy. So Gene had actually known several men who had gone into the Merchant Navy in their post-service days. And he felt like this would be the perfect place for Richard to kind of make some money, stay out of trouble, and most importantly, get the hell off his couch.
Yeah, that is important.
That part, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Gene took Richard to the Coast Guard office to get everything he needed for his apprentice seaman's license. And this included a physical exam, getting fingerprinted, and having your photo taken. And within days, Richard had all the paperwork he needed, all signed, sealed, delivered, ready to go. And he went into the National Maritime Union Hall, which is abbreviated NMU. Sometime we'll use that throughout the story. And he luckily found a job immediately. And on April 30th, he said goodbye to Gene and Martha and set sail.
Oh, boy.
Speck on the high seas.
That's terrifying.
Yeah. So now in a recurring theme, this is where things could have gone well for Richard if we just said, hey, the story's over. Thanks for tuning in.
Have a good one.
Have a good one. But this first day or two on the boat was rough. Remember, when Richard wants to work, he is a damn good employee. Like, he had been revered throughout his life by several bosses when he was doing what he was supposed to do. It was the other side of Richard that no one liked.
Oh, yeah.
So now he's working in a place that wants no alcohol, no women, which, as we've heard, are Speck's two biggest vices. Like, he could have thrived if he would have just put some effort into it.
Yeah, but we know by now nothing with this man is that easy.
No. No. To quote the Townhouse Massacre book, it was as though the universe couldn't tolerate a version of Richard who was anything more than a monster. End quote.
It's monster. That is exactly the word to describe him.
Facts. Well, on May 3rd, just a few days into his new life, Richard became violently ill. Like, he was in excruciating pain to the point where he was blacking out and not making any sense. They ended up having to get a chopper in to get him off from the boat all the way to St. Joseph's Hospital in Hancock, Michigan, where he was rushed into emergency surgery for an appendix. It was that his appendix was bursting. Oof. And fun fact, this actually happened to me when I was working for Forensic Files. There was a Chinese buffet up the street that we'd always go to for lunch. And we came back one day and I was in it, like, doubled over on the floor of my cubicle for hours. And I thought it was like bad General Tso's. It was my appendix. I had to go to the hospital. They rushed me.
I didn't know that. Oh my God, that's horrifying.
Anyway, when Richard was discharged, he goes back to Martha and Jean's home. Lucky them.
Oh, sure. They were pumped. So I found this part of the book really interesting. And I don't think we mentioned this in part one, but Richard's sister Martha had been a nurse prior to getting married and having children.
Mm-hmm.
And because of this, and because she was a woman, Richard always seemed to expect her to take care of him. And by now, I feel like she has done her fair share of caring for him him. I mean, how many times have she and Jean bailed his ass out of trouble, given him money, they've let him stay with them? He is like a leech to them, but he still is upset with his sister because he feels that she's not like doting on him after his surgery.
Isn't that insane? Like, she has definitely, there were at least three or four times in this story alone that they helped him out. So I can't imagine the times we didn't talk about.
Yeah, but he doesn't see it like that, which is wild.
No, he doesn't. Well, after a week of Richard being discharged from the hospital, so now we're talking about May 20th, Richard was back on the seas. But this time, the work ethic that he had demonstrated the first time around was completely gone.
Mm-hmm.
And within days, Richard was drinking heavily, which we just mentioned was against the rules. And because the guys in charge had kind of a keep your head down, get your shit done, and we'll all pretend you're not like a raging alcoholic kind of attitude, which is is great, but he couldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So this worked for a few days, but Richard went into one of his unhinged rage moods and got into it with one of the ship's officers, and Richard was dumped on shore immediately. And I don't know exactly where he was kind of thrown on shore, but they basically said, you're not getting paid. Find your own way home. Peace. So Richard makes his way back to Chicago, and yet again, he's on the doorstep of Martha and Jean.
Ugh.
And it's probably not even necessary to say that they were pissed.
Mm-hmm.
So every morning, Jean would drag Richard back to the NMU and try to get him a job.
How many chances are Jean and Martha going to give him?
Is it because it's their brother? Like, it's just this familial obligation?
I almost feel like she felt like a second mom to him. Because remember, she's so much older than he is. So I almost wonder if she sees him as like a surrogate son kind of thing. And you never want to give up on your children.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately for Richard, and even more unfortunate for Martha and Jean, word had gotten out about Richard being a drunken a-hole.
Mm-hmm.
So day after day, he would be back on their couch. No job, no money. There were a few times when someone would be desperate enough to kind of take Richard in. Maybe they just felt really bad. But if any other seaman came along, they would toss Richard aside. And each time, this would set him off into this rage mode that he goes into. And he would finally spend all weekend just whining about how awful his life is, to the point where Martha and Jean finally had enough. And they told him to leave.
Good for them, though. He's so self-destructive and so ungrateful. And I'm glad they finally set up some boundaries.
Well, but you know Richard didn't see it that way. Like, his sister and Jean were the bad guys. Duh.
Of course.
Well, eventually Richard finds a room for rent in an establishment called Pauline's. And once his accommodations were settled, Richard goes out drinking. What else? This went on for hours. And the next day he woke up, his typical morning hangover, and decided to get up and go to the NMU to see if there was any work available. So, I mean, he did that on his own, at least.
Shockingly.
Right. So he'd spent the entire day there, and this was a place where you would kind of just show up in the morning, wait, and just see if any jobs came along or you were offered anything, and if not, you go home. So basically, after this day goes on, everyone else had given up, they'd gone home, and Richard finally got called to work on an oil tanker. And while this was a great opportunity, it was also docked on the complete other side of town, which meant Richard needed a ride and placed a call to his brother Gene. Biggest fan.
Womp womp.
And sources say Richard felt like Gene was gloating and making sure that Richard knew that he was a complete loser. But honestly, even if that's not true, could you blame Gene?
Right?
Well, anyway, when they get to the port, the position had been given to somebody else. And I feel like this is the final nail in the proverbial coffin, because there had actually been some kind of mix-up where someone else had been given Richard's position, which, in case you haven't been seeing a pattern here, sends Richard into a blind rage.
Oof.
So Gene drives Richard back to the area around the NMU, and Richard spends the night sleeping in an abandoned house. I don't know if Gene said, "You're not coming home. Figure it out."
Well, remember, they had kicked him out already.
I know, but it's like you'd think if they saw he was trying, maybe they let him back in. I don't know. I guess
that's
not.
That's true. Yeah, I see that.
Yeah. Right. But anyway, he stays in this abandoned house, which he did it throughout his childhood. So this is the night before the murders, and the next day is Wednesday, July 13th, 1966. And of course, Richard wakes up angry at the world, but he did get up and begin making his way to the NMU. I think he needs money, you know, just to drink. I think it's a vicious cycle. This money isn't for his future. So not long after he shows up, it kind of dawns on Richard that he's a liability, and his chance of getting a job is slim to none. He had given up hope on any type of employment, and what else was there to do but hit the bars? So that's what he did.
Of course.
Yep. And he drank and he drank and he drank some more. And at some point, Richard realized, hey, I'm out of money, which does tend to happen when you don't work for a living.
It's funny how it works out like that.
Crazy, right? Well, while finishing his last drink, a local sex worker, 53-year-old Ella Mae Hooper, asked if he was interested in any of her quote unquote services. And Richard, we know, does not have any money, but Ella Mae doesn't know that. So Richard takes her to this dirty-ass rented motel room, and as soon as the door is shut, pulls out his knife and tells her to hand over all our money. And this was not Ella Mae's first rodeo, and I imagine in that profession you have to take precautions, to which she did. This badass chick pulls out a .22 caliber revolver, and apparently it wasn't anything special because the sources kind of kept mentioning that this was a smaller, they called it a mail order gun, which I don't even know what that is, and I looked it up, and I still don't know what it means.
Yeah, I don't, like, did you literally order it through the mail? Is that legal?
I don't
what
know.
What is happening?
Yeah, I don't know. 1966, if they had magazines and you could order gun. I don't know either. Well, regardless, it was still a gun. Unfortunately, Richard was a lot quicker than her and grabbed the gun out of her hands. And he pushes Ella Mae down on the bed and he rapes her in what was described as a brief but brutal attack. And when he was finished, he stole Ella Mae's money anyway and told her to get out. So this Fleabag motel, which Richard was staying, amazingly, there was a bar downstairs. So
shocker.
Take a guess where Richard went. And while he was drowning his sorrows, Richard decides the alcohol wasn't cutting it tonight and decided to buy some heroin, which he injects with a syringe.
I'm pretty sure that this was new for Richard. Like, we know he loved to drink, and occasionally he would take pills, apparently, if he could find them. But from the research that I've done on him and reading the book, it doesn't seem like he had ever really been all that interested in harder drugs.
No, it was weird. It kind of came out of the blue when I read that. It's like, heroin? Where did that come? So I think this might be the first time he like experimented or tried it, because the other stuff wasn't cutting it anymore.
Wow.
So, and I'm sure you can imagine, though, it was a recipe for disaster. So Richard is drunk. He's now high on heroin and he's angry, like really angry. Well, around 10 p.m., Richard leaves the bar and begins walking in the direction of the NMU. But this time, he wasn't going to inquire about a job. He was going to commit the crime of the century.
Wow. Ugh.
So we're going to go through how this night went. And then following that, we'll introduce you to each and every one of these beautiful, intelligent, incredible young women.
Yes. Thanks to Shannon. We feel like we found a lot of really great information about each girl, and we wanted to share it with everyone. So as we've said before, the victims are what this is all about.
Absolutely right. And we did feel, though, that it would take us out of the moment if we interrupted the details of this kind of chilling attack to introduce 8 victims and their stories. It's just a lot. So we're going to do it at the end. But back to the night. So by the time Richard makes it to the area around Union Hall, it was about 11 p.m. So just a block away from NMU was a row of brick townhouses. And these were located at 2319 100th Street. And we know Richard spent many days hanging around like Union Hall for work. But what we didn't know is that he wasn't just waiting for a job there. He was watching. He was studying. He was lurking.
Oh.
He was watching the young women in the area, specifically the women that were in this N unit of the townhouse. And he watched them come and go, go to class, go to work, just living their lives, just completely unaware that a madman was keeping track of every move they made. So Richard had learned that there were 8 women living in that home and 0 men. So just like our Anthony Allen Shore case, Richard Speck learns their routines. And that night, in his alcohol and heroin-induced stupor, he makes his way into that small brick townhouse.
Oh, my goodness. This is so scary. And the fact that he's just been watching them and knows their routine.
They have no idea.
Yes, and they don't know he exists. That is the scariest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah. And now this rage is heading your way like a freight train, and you don't even know.
I just got the chills. I hate this.
Well, the next part does differ a bit according to the sources that you look at, so don't come at me. But we believe that he broke into this house through a window and proceeded to make his way through the house, and he knocked on the first door he saw. And he comes across 22-year-old Cora Amorau. And I apologize, Cora, if you're out there. We have looked, it's pronounced differently every place we look. So I'm sorry for not pronouncing it, but Cora Amorau. And she was getting into bed when she heard the knock and assumed it was one of her roommates coming home. But when she opens the door, Richard is standing there, pointing a gun directly in her face.
Oh my God.
So Richard walks toward her and she's backing up and he asks her, quote, "Where are your companions?"
Oh my God. Try to put yourself in the situation that Cora is in.
I can't even begin. To what it's like to, I've never had a gun pointed at my face, a loaded gun. That alone is terrifying.
That alone is enough. Yes.
Well, and remember, we know that Richard is very soft-spoken. He has this like slow Texas Southern drawl. And while he is like a tall man, he has this really young face, although kind of pockmarked and mutilated. But I imagine his overall demeanor isn't really threatening. Then again, he also has a gun pointed at your face, which is pretty threatening. So get this. So the Townhouse Massacre book talks about how he was envisioning Shirley this whole time. Like, he obviously knew that Cora was a small Filipino woman and not Shirley. But he was so angry and like under the influence of all these drugs and alcohol that his anger was like playing tricks on his mind.
That's scary, too. Everything about this is scary.
Yeah. So now he's like unhinged on top of everything.
Oh, my God.
Well, by now, so there's another roommate, 23-year-old Merlita Gargullo, G-A-R-G-U-L-L-O. And again, I apologize. I can't roll my R's. I can't combine my L's.
I can't either.
I know. It's so hard, but this does not detract. We'll call her Marlita. That's I just wanted to tell you her last name. She was another young woman who hailed from the Philippines and had awoken, and she was now standing face to face with Richard, who was pointing a gun at her now. So now you have Cora, Marlita, and Richard are all standing in this hallway, and Richard waves the gun kind of like, follow me, or like get moving type of movement. And when he opens the door to the next bedroom, he pushes Cora and Marlita into the room where he saw 3 other women sleeping already. So suddenly he hears this gasp, and another roommate had been in the bathroom. So now we have 6 women all in a room with a crazed gunman. And in the book, the author talks about how Richard was like trying to mentally keep track of how many women there are. I imagine the scene was fairly chaotic.
And I imagine everyone's just frozen in fear.
Yeah, I would say so, with good reason. So Richard grabs this woman from the bathroom by her hair and basically throws her into the bedroom right behind Cora and Marlita. And Richard knows there are 2 more women living in the home because, again, he'd been watching. He knows everything about this place. So he turns around and steps back out in the hallway, but he doesn't hear anybody else. So maybe he thinks they're not home at this point.
I also wonder what was happening in his brain because he was on so many different things. The alcohol, the heroin.
Well, we learn later that he doesn't have feelings.
True.
So I imagine
very
he was
true.
Just numb.
Oh.
Well, when he spins back around to face his victims, he realizes that 3 of the girls were actually attempting to hide in the closet. And he tells the women, quote, "It's all right. Calm down. I ain't here to hurt nobody," end quote. So he turns to 20-year-old Pamela Lee Wilkening, and he tells her to get the other girls out of the closet. And she does as she's instructed, obviously. She's got a gun pointed at her. Mm-hmm. So when he has all six women in front of him, and he tells them to sit on the floor in this, like, semicircle. It was very, like, ritualistic. It reminds me of, like, some kind of cult or something.
Yeah, I never thought of it that way, but you're right. It's a weird thing to do.
Yeah.
What I hate the most about this part is that he managed to get them at such a vulnerable moment.
They're in their nightgowns.
Yes, they're in their nightgowns. They're getting ready to sleep. Like, or the other girls were asleep.
Mm-hmm. They were, right.
He is awful.
He is awful. Well, the next thing Richard does is he leans down so he's closer to the women. It's kind of like a coach talking to his football team. It's just disturbing as anything. And he tells them, again, I ain't going to hurt nobody. He just needed money to get to New Orleans. So first of all, I do believe that this was a burglary at one point. I think that was his initial intent because this guy needed money to drink. That was his only concern. But also New Orleans? Question mark?
Yeah, that's so random because I don't remember hearing anything in his life about New Orleans like prior to this.
No.
So why he picked that city, I'm not sure.
I don't know. And I don't know if that was the place that he was going to go disappear and start a new life after this goes down, because he knows it's not going to be good. But one of the women asked Richard if they could get their purses. And he agreed, but he told him he needed to do them one at a time. And again, he's trying to maintain this scene that has multiple women. We talked Yogurt Shop. This reminds me a little bit of Yogurt Shop because, like, do they have experience controlling this many people?
And especially in a place that you're not familiar with.
Right. Like he obviously did not study the inside of this place. He studied the outside. So Richard is pointing the gun at this group of women. And what he does is he'll follow them one by one as they leave the room, go out, get their purse, come back, hand over their money. And when one sits down, the next one's up. And eventually all the women turn over everything they had. But keep in mind that Richard had threatened these women because he told them if one of them tries anything, he's going to shoot the rest. So now they're under that pressure.
Yeah, I think people often wonder, you know, there's more of them than him. Why didn't they get up? But I understand following his directions.
Yeah, you do what you're told to do. Right.
Yes.
Well, Richard is happily taking their cash and just smiling like a complete monster when suddenly they hear the front door fly open and 22-year-old Gloria Jean Davey enters the home. And Gloria had been out with her boyfriend. She'd had a few drinks, so she was pretty tipsy, actually, when she made her way upstairs. And she tries to open the door quietly. She doesn't want to wake anybody up, so she kind of creeps into the room. And the scene that awaited her up there made her scream. And this scream was silenced by Richard as he grabs her and throws her to the floor. And his next move is to pull a sheet off the bed, pull out his 17-inch carving knife, and kind of cut strips. He could use them to tie up his terrified victims. He now had a way to control them even further. So he claims he was only tying him up, though, so that they wouldn't call the police like as soon as he leaves. But that was it. Like, he wasn't going to hurt them. They were going to be fine.
It almost reminds me of what we talked about last week. He's got the tattoo of his daughter and the tattoo of the Born to Raise Hell.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like this angel devil thing going on. And it's almost like that when he commits his crimes. He's threatening them, but then he's being really nice. It's so strange.
Well, I'm not smart enough to figure this out, to be completely honest, but obviously the young women are completely confused and basically trusting him to keep his word that he just needed money and then he was out of there. And the last girl he tied up was 20-year-old Pamela Lee Wilkening. After she was bound, Richard took her to another room and had her lay down. He then pulled his knife out of the sheath, but before he had a chance to hurt Pamela, the front door opens again. And this time it was 21-year-old Suzanne Farris and 20-year-old Mary Ann Jordan. The girls had been out for the day and they were just returning home. So they come into this house and they're laughing and joking, as you would do if you didn't think anything was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But as they make their way to the bedrooms, they first see Pamela lying on the floor with a man holding a knife right over her.
Oh my God.
So they understandably scream as they turn to flee, and they make it to a back bedroom where they come upon their friends, the roommates and fellow nurses that were tied up and terrified on the floor. Like, it just gets worse with every room. It's like an awful funhouse.
Yeah.
Well, Richard caught up and grabbed both women and begins pulling them toward another bedroom. And these two girls are yelling. They're kicking and screaming, trying to get away, while all the girls sitting on the floor are pleading with Richard not to hurt their friends. Like, imagine this scene.
I can't honestly even imagine it.
No. Well, so Richard drags Suzanne and Marianne to one of the bedrooms and he slams the door. And Marianne was fighting. And this is so sick, but it's almost like this is what Richard was waiting for. Like he wanted someone to fight back so that in his mind, it was an excuse to silence her. That's the way I'm kind of seeing it. Mm-hmm. And with that, he shoves the knife into her stomach.
Oh,
it's such a personal attack.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's like, usually with those kind of attacks, like you said, it's personal. It's someone you know. You don't know these people. What is happening? Yeah.
So I want to read this particularly disturbing quote from the book. Quote, "No pleasure any woman could give would ever be as sweet as that little gasp she made when she realized that her life was over. And it was all because of him, because he was more powerful than her, because he decided that her life should end at this moment." End quote.
That's what all of this is about, though.
Yeah.
Like power. And he's so pathetic and so insecure. Mm-hmm. He needs this power to feel like a real man. And I often wonder if anyone pointed out to him that anybody can be tough when you have a knife and a gun and sneak up on someone while they're sleeping.
Well, that's a very fair assessment. And Richard pushes Suzanne onto the bed and basically threw himself on top of her and began choking her. And Suzanne fought, and she fought hard. But within a few minutes, she had stopped fighting. She stopped kicking, stopped moving. When he was sure that both women were dead, he leaves the room, headed back into the bathroom to wash his hands. And this would become a weird habit. A weird trait of his.
Mm-hmm.
But his next victim was Pamela, who was laying on her back, still in the one room all by herself. So Richard kicks Pamela, and then he straddles her with his knife pointed directly over her chest.
Oh.
And slowly and cruelly and deliberately, he plunges this knife directly into her chest several times.
My God.
And when he was done, he took one of the girl's white stockings and tied it around Pamela's throat. And we'll come to see that he does this to quite a few of his victims. So Richard stood up, he heads to the bathroom to again wash his hands. So Richard heads back down the hallway to the room where the majority of the girls were still kind of bound and on the floor. And Jesus, imagine this. So they were trying their best to drag themselves into a hiding place because remember, they're bound, so it's incredibly hard to move.
Yeah.
And as Richard's like scanning the room, his eyes fall on Nina and he makes direct eye contact with her. And he goes over and unties her legs. And then he turns to the rest of the girls and tells them that he wanted to talk to her, but just her, not the group. So he singled her out.
No, anything you need to say to her, you can say in front of all of us.
This wasn't going to the principal's office. This was going somewhere way worse. Well, and as Richard is marching poor Nina down the hallway, he's still reassuring her. He's like, I'm not going to hurt you.
I feel like at this point, Nina knew he was lying.
Oh, yeah, because it was pretty clear that he was hurting the people in that house at this point. So he pushes her down on the bed and he takes a pillow in an attempt to smother her. And Nina fought like hell, so much that Richard began to lose control a little bit. And it was then that he pulled out his knife and stabs her right in the throat.
Oh, God.
And Richard yet again heads to the bathroom where he washes his hands and then goes back in the bedroom.
I'm sure there's some psychology here to dissect with like all that hand washing.
So this is kind of dark and sadistic, but it's just stuff I've learned from working some of these cases. When you are stabbing someone and there's blood everywhere, the knife will slip out of your hands if your hands are bloody and you will cut yourself a lot of times. So I wonder if that was him literally washing his hands to get a good grip for what he was about to do.
It very much might have been.
It could be that simple. Well, the girls are trying desperately to hide, but to no avail. So Richard grabs Valentina and carries her into a separate bedroom. And when he was finished killing her, he yet again goes to the bathroom and washes his hands. Wow. Richard's next victim is Marlita. Following the same routine after killing her, washes his hands. Richard goes back into the room with the other girls and grabs Patricia Matusik. So according to Ryan Green's book that we've been referencing this whole time, Pat is the one who originally caught Richard's eye. Supposedly she reminded him of Ginny. Remember the barmaid that we talked about in part one?
Mm-hmm. She gave you Killer Sally vibes.
Yes, the wrestler.
Yeah. Well,
in the same vicious manner that he killed poor Mary Kate Pierce, he punches Patricia as hard as he can right in the stomach, which ruptured her liver.
Oh, God.
Was weird when I read that. I was like, you're kidding me. Like two punches on two women ruptured both of their livers. Like, is that where your liver is?
Yeah, I guess so. Or wherever, however he punched.
Crazy. Well, she falls to the ground and she takes her final breath moments later. So I do want to tell you what's happening back in the bedroom. So remember Cora? Well, she had managed to wedge herself under this like metal bed frame, and the bed was up against the wall, and she got as far under this bed as humanly possible to get away from this madman. And I think by this point, Richard believed that he had killed all but one woman. Remember, he was keeping like a mental count in his head.
Yeah.
And the last girl in the room besides Cora was Gloria Jean. And remember, Gloria had been a bit intoxicated when she got home. So she had actually fallen asleep on the bedroom floor. And Richard leans down and he rips her dress and then takes out his knife and cuts off her underwear. And he begins assaulting her. And while this is happening, she wakes up. She kind of comes to and she begins screaming and fighting and punching and kicking and doing all the things to get him off of her. So he takes the knife and he presses it to her throat as he continually sexually assaults her. And when he was finished, he drags Gloria through the house and took one of the strips of bedsheet that he was cutting up, and he proceeded to choke her. And Richard then washed his hands again and calmly leaves the house through the front door, walks out as if he was just stopping over for coffee.
That's it. Walks out.
End of story. Yeah. And he walks back to his hotel room and he finished washing up, and then he goes to bed without a care in the world. Which meant in less than an hour, he had just murdered 8 young, beautiful, vibrant women. Insane.
What he did, there are absolutely no words that I or anyone else could say that could ever carry the weight of what you just said. Like, right. These women were nurses. They were women who had chosen one of the most selfless paths that I think a person can take. You know, like, they're getting their life started and preparing to help people, to heal strangers, to save lives. Mm-hmm. But instead, their own lives are taken before they ever even had the chance to fully become who they were meant to be.
Could not agree with that statement more. And now we want to share with you who these women were, because we cannot consider them Richard Speck's victims. They were so much more than that. This is our favorite part.
Yes.
So I'm actually going to let you do the honors. And again, thank you, Shannon Byers, for helping us kind of honor these women. You helped us do a lot of research on them to give us these backstories that we're going to tell you. So they offered kind of small windows into the lives that were filled with so much promise and so much greatness.
I wrote that line. It's pretty good, right?
Pretty not bad.
Whenever I write something that's like that was me. Deep, I'm like,
I did that.
Everyone's going to think it's ChatGPT, but it's me. Well, the first woman I want to tell you about is 20-year-old Mary Ann Jordan. And this is wild. She didn't actually live in the house anymore. That's why he got confused and didn't realize he missed Cora, because he counted 8 women. So Mary Ann shouldn't have even been there. She had actually recently moved out of the home, and she moved back in with her parents and siblings. So Mary Ann was 4th out of 6 kids, and she and her siblings, they loved hearing stories that their Irish grandmother, this woman named Grace, would tell. She had been a high-ranking surgical nurse in the early 1900s.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, and these stories are what inspired Mary Ann to think of a nursing career for herself.
It was in the family.
Right. And then on top of that, Mary Ann's brother Billy had Down syndrome, which made her want to specialize in pediatric nursing, which I think is really beautiful.
It's so cool.
When she was growing up, she really loved swimming, ice skating, softball, and she could pretty much always be found playing baseball in the alley by her house.
That's cool.
And she also loved roller skating in her basement, which is so wholesome. I love
that. That's right. What else do you do before the internet?
Exactly. I remember rollerblading in Stephanie Liptak's basement.
Oh, not me.
In third grade.
You were in Stephanie's basement.
So that night, she and her future sister-in-law, Susie Ferris, they had actually been at Mary Ann's home talking about Susie's upcoming wedding. She was about to marry Mary Ann's brother, Phil.
Oh.
So like, that's so cool. Your friend gets to be your sister-in-law. That's awesome.
That is cool. That's the best case.
It really is. And she was like going to stay at home that night, but Susie actually convinced her to come back to the townhouse just, you know, to have a sleepover.
God.
I know.
And the circumstances that have to come together.
It's so crazy. We talk about this every time. Susie was only one of 21-year-old Suzanne Bridget Ferris's nicknames. Her family also called her Cookie, which I think is so cute. And she was one of 3 kids, and they grew up in this cramped 2-bedroom Cape Cod home. Susie and her sister Marilyn, they shared a room, and then her brother John had his own room, while her parents slept on the hideaway bed in the living room.
Oh my God.
Wow, that's... So Susie's mom and dad had grown up together and then gotten married, and they all liked to cook together. They would mix this sour cream and dry onion soup to make this French onion dip that they all loved when they would play solitaire.
I think that's still a recipe. I think that's still a thing today.
I know. I feel like that sounds so good.
Yeah. I think I've seen that at parties.
Well, Susie was described as pretty, perky, and popular. She loved clothes, and she actually made some of her own because, you know, her family didn't have a ton of money. She had taken an administrative job to pay for night college before eventually deciding to enroll in nursing school. And nursing was not necessarily her first calling, but she had this uncommon ease with the dying, and she also had no problems, you know, kind of dealing with the various forms of messes that nurses often see.
Yeah, I hear it's pretty gross.
Yeah. She had hoped to specialize in pediatric nursing, and we know that she was engaged to be married to Marianne's brother, Phil. They were going to get married the following spring.
Cool.
And she and Marianne had been hanging out, talking about the wedding, and she convinced her to, you know, come back to the townhouse. Like, let's have a sleepover. And they were the last two women to arrive to the house that night.
Wow.
Well, prior to Marianne and Susie coming home, remember, 22-year-old Gloria Jean Davy, she had come home. She had been out with her boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
So Gloria was the second of six children from Dyer, Indiana, and she was the daughter of a former Marine. And this is so cool, and it reminds me of the Yogurt Shop Girls, but she was a former national sweetheart of Future Farmers of America.
Oh my God. Yeah, that was the first. This was like the 4-H.
And she had actually recently just been elected president of the Illinois Nursing Student Association. Isn't that wild?
That is wild. Good for her.
So she was actually set to complete her training in August of that year, so just the following month, and she planned on joining the Peace Corps, which is really inspiring. She was described as driven, independent, intelligent, headstrong, poised, creative, and maybe a little bit snippy here and there.
I mean, who isn't, really?
Who isn't, exactly. So Gloria had originally started college as an English major, but she changed her life goal to nursing. And that day, July 13th, 1966, was supposed to be her last night in the townhouse.
Oh my God. How awful.
I know. She had plans to move home the next day, and then she was set to graduate in just a few short weeks.
God. So tragic.
This is so heartbreaking, but on August 7th, 1966, her sister Lori was presented with Gloria's diploma during the class graduation.
That was only a month after, not even like 3 weeks. That had to be so hard for her to walk up there. But at the same time, I feel like she was doing it for her sister. So,
yeah. And get this, she was only 11 years old.
Wow. Really?
I know. She walked up on that stage wearing a plaid dress and white gloves, accepted the diploma. And she just walked across that stage with square shoulders, and surprisingly, I don't know how she did it, but she wasn't crying. She was proudly carried that diploma that her sister had worked so hard for.
What a brave little girl.
I know. Isn't that amazing?
Incredible.
So remember that Richard had taken the one young woman to a separate room?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was 20-year-old Pamela Lee Wilkening. And she sounds like such a freaking cool chick. She was a race car enthusiast with this zany sense of humor, and she was described as the sweetest girl you'd ever want to know. But she was also described as like quiet and studious.
That's crazy. It's like two versions of herself. She's got the maniac race car driver and then the bookworm.
Yeah, exactly. That's why. Funny. I was like, she seems so cool. She seems so well-rounded.
Versatile, yeah.
So her brother Jack actually thought that her diligence and temperament were qualities that would make her a really good military nurse. And when she filled out her nurse's training application, she wrote, quote, "I have always wanted to be a nurse. I never like to see people suffer," end quote. Pam had last spoken with her mother just a few days before she had been killed because she had called her mom to say that she had decided to stay at the townhouse for the weekend to study for her final exams.
Could have been anywhere else.
I know. But this girl was just so dedicated to her studies. And get this, so when she was doing her psychiatric rotation, she was slugged by a patient so hard she hit her head against a brick wall and suffered a concussion. But she came right back to nursing. Like, that is serious commitment. I'd be like, I don't know if this is for me.
You're like, I can't do this. This is a hazard.
Yeah. I feel like all the women were incredibly dedicated, but they also still found time for a little bit of fun here and there. And actually, earlier that year, they had had the nurses' spring dance where 21-year-old Nina Jo Schmale had been dubbed the queen of the dance.
Man.
And it seems like she had found her king as she was engaged to her high school sweetheart. After graduation in 1959, she had gotten a job as a secretary, but she really didn't like it. But she did enjoy her volunteer work at an elder care home. And that experience and the fact that her older brother was actually studying to be a doctor, that really helped her to make the decision when she was 19 years old that she wanted to be a nurse.
It's like all these women were inspired by other people in their life. It's really cool.
Yeah, they all have like a really beautiful reason for wanting to be a nurse, I feel like.
Very cool.
Well, Nina and her brother John had attended school together at a one-room schoolhouse that they walked to each day carrying their lunches in tin pails. How wholesome are they?
I love it. With Transformers all over. Probably not.
That was a little pre-Transformers.
That was mine. That was mine.
Well, ultimately, Nina was just a good kid who loved Elvis, cats, the color pink, and she was so dedicated to being a good caregiver.
Amazing.
21-year-old Patricia Ann Matusik, she was also a good caregiver, and her passion for helping others started when she was really young. But before I tell you like what inspired her to become a nurse, I had to share this. So prior to nursing school, she had been on her high school's water ballet team, and she was a champion swimmer.
I'm sorry, water ballet?
Yes! Isn't that so cool?
Like synchronized swimming?
I guess so. I think that's the same thing.
Mm.
So when Patricia was 14 years old, her cousin Tommy, who was a year older at age 15, he was admitted to the hospital, and I don't know why, but ultimately, he was suffering from something terminal, and they just knew that his time was limited. But Patricia had spent so much time in the hospital with him, you know, fluffing his pillows, getting him drinks, and just being there to hold his hand. And it was this experience that made her want to be a nurse, which is so beautiful.
That is.
Pat had grown up over her father's tavern and right next door to a funeral home. So it kind of gave her this kind of grit growing up that would also lend herself to nursing.
Yeah.
Pat is remembered as being sweet, assertive, funny, and full of life. And on the day of the murder, she found out that she had been accepted as a staff member at the City Children's Memorial Hospital.
All these women would have gone on to do such great things.
Oh, such amazing things. Well, in her application for the position, she had written, quote, "Ever since I can remember, I've wanted to be a nurse because I enjoy helping those in need. The joy one gets from helping others cannot be taken away," end quote. So I wasn't aware of this until we started researching the case, but apparently not all of the women in the house were nursing students.
That's true. I didn't know that either.
Yeah, three of them had actually already graduated, and they were part of a Filipino exchange program.
Yeah, I just always assumed, and again, we just dug into this case recently, but before that, it was just like 8 nursing students. I just thought that's what it was.
Yeah, I feel like that's what papers said, and that's a lot of times it's known as the nursing school murders.
Right.
Well, 23-year-old Valentina Pasan, she went by Tina with her family. She was part of a group of Filipina exchange nurses who came to America to learn new things, make new friends, and of course, to work. So Valentina had graduated in the top 10 nursing students in her class at Manila Central University, which is in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm. That's the capital.
Well, the third time was a charm on her application for her passport so that she could continue her education in the United States. And when she had landed in Chicago in May of 1966, there was still snow on the ground, which,
oh my God.
Yeah, is a far cry from the town of Jones that she had called home.
I'll say.
So when she arrived in the States, she was taken to that townhouse where she joined Merlita and Corazon, who had arrived just a few days before she got there. In letters that she sent to her family, she mentioned that she was going to send them money to help fix their home. She also talked about the terrible weather in Chicago, but she did tell her sister that she loved the city and really did want to stay there. Like, that's where she wanted to be.
Wow. Well, can you imagine going from the Philippines to Chicago? I mean, it's a lot more to do, I'll tell you that.
It has to be a culture shock.
Literal opposite.
Yeah. Well, Tina was known as a good cook and often hosted other exchange nurses for her well-known pancit, which was made of noodles, vegetables, and pork.
That sounds delicious.
It really does. So another one of the exchange nurses was 23-year-old Merlita Gargullo. So according to sources, Merlita would sometimes perform this really amazing bamboo dance, and she had native clacking poles that she had brought from home, which she was from the island of Mindoro. She had helped raise her 8 younger siblings, and she had done so well in school, she was able to attend the nursing program at Arellano University in Manila.
Very cool.
So in the spring of 1966, she and Corazon flew to the United States to continue their education, and they would end up residing with Tina at the townhouse. Merlita was known to be quiet and shy, but she was really hardworking. And she had a beautiful singing voice, which could often be heard around the townhouse when she was like doing her chores. She'd just start singing.
It's such a wholesome environment.
It is.
God.
Well, she earned about $350 a month, and most of it she sent back to her family. And she wrote them so many letters. And her last letter home detailed a field trip she had taken to Wisconsin, where she described the excursion as fine, dizzying, exciting, and wonderful. But she also said, I still believe there is no place like home.
Oh, that's cute.
This is heartbreaking. Merlita's father waited out in the rain when she was returned to her homeland.
God, it's soul crushing.
It really is. And I also want to share what we found out about our courageous and incredibly brave survivor, 22-year-old Cora. She was the only survivor. Cora was nicknamed Zoni, and she was a shy, modest country girl from Royal Batangas, which was a province some 60 miles from Manila. And this was a place known for its volcanoes, beaches, and traditional folding knife called a balisong.
Wow. Learning a lot about the Philippines today.
I know. Well, Cora was one of 8 children from a village of only 200 people. Her native language was Tagalog, but she started learning English in the first grade. So after she graduated from the Far Eastern University in Manila, she worked as a staff nurse, and then she applied for work in the United States. Cora was still bewildered by the clatter and bustle of this strange American city. She had actually arrived there on May 1st, 1966. And she wasn't a student, but she was actually an employee at the same hospital that the other girls were doing their rotations at. Cora and Merlita shared a room upstairs, and Cora was the first one to come face to face with Richard Speck when he knocked on that bedroom door.
Yeah, Cora, we're going to talk more about this badass in a little bit, but getting back to the case. So this whole time, Cora is still hiding under the bed. And she would end up staying under there for several hours and not coming out till 5 o'clock in the morning, which is where we started our case last week when neighbor Judy heard all this screaming. They're all dead. They're all dead.
Wow.
So you can completely understand why she was staying hidden for so long.
Oh my God. What if the killer was still there just hiding somewhere waiting for her to move?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Well, when she finally gained the courage, she crawls out from under this bed. She pushes out the window screen and climbs out to this little ledge, which that alone is terrifying. You're on a second story ledge.
Yeah.
So she begins screaming at the top of her lungs over and over again. They're all dead. They're all dead. My God, they're all dead. And of course, Judy is like, what is she talking about?
Mm-hmm.
And Judy actually opens the front door and immediately sees Gloria's body.
Oh my God.
So there was like this house mother for like all of the students in the townhouses. So that's who Judy went to go get when all this went down. And mother didn't believe Judy, so she went over to the house and again was horrified by what she saw.
Mm-hmm.
She immediately calls police, and luckily there was an officer not too far away. He was just kind of out patrolling when he first got there. And this poor guy, his name was Daniel Kelly. He had only been a cop for like a year. So he walks into this, and even more horrifying, the first person he sees is Gloria. And the reason this is so horrifying is because not only did he know her, he dated Gloria's sister at one point. So Officer Kelly bravely goes through the rest of the home to make sure the killer wasn't lurking around. He had to clear the house. Then he uses his police radio to call for help, saying, quote, "Oh God, give me the sergeant. I dated her sister. Oh God, I've never seen anything like this," end quote.
I imagine seeing someone you know like that has to be so eerie and jarring, like looking at them and realizing who it is.
Looking at them in that state, absolutely. Well, somehow a local reporter named Joe Cummings, he gets to the scene quicker than police. So when he arrives to the site, he sees several women standing outside and they're crying, and he sees Officer Kelly. And I imagine Joe was incredibly confused because he tried to get information from the officer, but all Kelly could muster up was the word homicide. So in several sources mentioned how Joe was kind of like, oh man, what a rookie, right? And even when he went inside and saw the first body, he was still like, all right, homicide. What's the big deal? Like, you want to be an officer. This is pretty routine. But then he very quickly joins in Officer Kelly's trauma as he makes his way through the home, and then he runs outside to throw up in the shrubs. That's how bad this crime scene was.
Wow.
So by now, more officers had arrived, as had medical personnel. And if I'll put pictures on screen, there was a crowd of people that were in this parking lot. I mean, things must have been different back then, but this crime scene did not look overly controlled because there were people right up against the building.
Yeah, they didn't really seal the crime scene very well.
No, not at all. Well, yeah, the reporter's walking through it too.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually sedated Cora because she was so traumatized.
Of course.
Right. Well, in a move that I'm actually really happy to mention, police didn't make Cora talk to them right away. So she was taken to a hospital. Luckily, they were able to get a basic description from Cora, including the fact that the perpetrator had this sweet Born to Raise Hell tattoo. So immediately they begin hunting for the vicious maniac who committed these awful crimes. And meanwhile, Richard, who now had pockets full of money from robbing these women, was already drinking that money away. And of course, the murders are the talk of the town. I mean, this was the biggest event to happen, not just there, but probably in Illinois ever.
Yeah.
And everyone in the bar is just completely shocked. So while Richard is knocking back booze, police have hit the ground running. And I feel like police officers did talk to everyone within several blocks because they had this description of Richard along with the description of his accent. Remember that slow Southern drawl?
Mm-hmm.
So one of the places that police visited was the NMU, and they're describing the suspect to the guy working. And he was like, pretty sure you're talking about Richard Speck. Let me pull his file. So back at the house, forensic techs at the time had inspected every single inch of that home, top to bottom, and they'd even gotten a fingerprint. Where could they compare that fingerprint, you ask?
Oh, maybe to the fingerprints in his NMU file.
Bingo. Yep. So after all that, Richard Speck was ID'd in less than 24 hours. After all that stuff we just talked about, this was like the shortest manhunt ever.
Not a criminal mastermind.
No. So police do start looking for him, but we know he's basically a drifter. So they did have a tough time tracking him down initially. But luckily, the NMU was able to help, and they assist police in setting up basically a sting.
Mm-hmm.
So they get a hold of Gene, who called Richard at the Shipyard Inn, and they tell him that they had a position for him. Like, Richard, hey, we got your job, man. He just needs to head down to the Union Hall and get the paperwork.
Well, I'm sure this is great, because he probably thought, like, not only can he make some money, but he can get the hell out of Dodge away from the manhunt that was, like, focused on him.
Well, yeah. Well, unfortunately, though, Richard was suspicious of this job offer, and he never shows.
Oh.
So he was tipped off somehow by something in Gene's voice, probably.
Yeah.
Well, Richard was able to get away and flee to the opposite side of the city. And for a short amount of time, he was safe, because word of the murders hadn't made it across the city just yet, because remember, no internet, no Google alerts, like police departments weren't connecting to one another as quickly as they are today. So in fact, other departments, they didn't even know the crimes happened at this point because news hadn't broke yet. So when Richard's feeling the heat, he's holed up in this crappy little flop house. And when he does venture out in search of alcohol, he sees his face on every newspaper, on the news, and immediately runs back into his room to promptly slit his wrists. He cut deep enough to actually do some real damage, but he passed out right there in the room. And when Richard was eventually found, he was rushed to the Cook County Hospital. This part is kind of wild. So while doctors are fighting to save Richard's life, The bodies of his victims, all these women, are being autopsied just floors below in the same hospital.
Wow.
And while doctors were working on Richard, they're able to see this very lame yet very distinctive tattoo, the same tattoo that Cora had described to police officers.
Yeah, you don't forget something as stupid as born to raise hell.
Oh, no, you don't. Well, Cook County resident surgeon Dr. Leroy Smith had been working to save Richard's life when he wiped some blood off of his arm. And Smith immediately recognized this from the description on the news, so he contacts police, and on July 19th, 1966, Richard Speck is arrested.
Wow. 3 days. Not even.
Not even.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
And they knew who it was right away. I mean, this description was, for as vague as it was enough to be like, oh, that guy. So in the days after the arrest, investigators expected some sort of, like, emotional breakdown from Richard, like some dramatic moment, maybe a confession. But it never came. Instead, they found a man who was calm, completely detached from the world, and unsettlingly ordinary. Speck sat through questioning without emotion, didn't cry, didn't rage out, and he didn't confess. Like, he denied any involvement, but without any urgency or outrage or anything. Like, I feel like when you're innocent, you flip out and say, nuh-uh.
Yeah.
And he just answered selectively. He avoided details completely. And then just completely clammed up when investigators tried to talk about the actual murders. And Richard never once asked about the victims, like showed no visible remorse. And per usual, he was just focused on himself, his injuries, his discomfort, and the fact that he hadn't had a drink.
And to me, that silence and like his complete nonchalance is just one of the most chilling aspects of the case.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause he just doesn't care.
Yeah, they're dead inside. Well, the DA in this case was a gentleman named William Martin, and from our research, this guy seems like not only a good attorney, but also a really good man. Mm-hmm. So he actually went and sat out at the hospital outside of Richard's room for days because he was afraid that while Richard was recuperating and like on all these pain meds and stuff, that anything he said could be fought against later by a defense attorney. And I wish we had more time to get into this part, but truthfully, William Martin, he did have reason to worry. So when Richard was arrested, this was just a few weeks after the U.S. Supreme Court decided Miranda versus Arizona. Everyone's heard Miranda rights.
Mm-hmm.
So it was literally 1 month before the murders. It was on June 13th, 1966.
Wow.
So as you can imagine, that ruling fundamentally changed police interrogations by requiring suspects to be informed of their rights. And that included the right to remain silent and the right to an attorney. And because Speck's arrest happened after that Miranda decision, detectives were like operating under these new kind of, and this rule's common sense to us now, but
yeah,
back when it was first passed, they were still kind of feeling this out, getting their feet wet on how to utilize this law. Like, any misstep during questioning could seriously jeopardize the entire case. And as a result, police and the DA had to be extremely cautious with Speck. And this is one of the reasons that I think Speck never gave a full confession, because he was never pushed.
Right.
So, but if it worked both ways, because prosecutors didn't even really need his confession. So instead of relying on statements from Speck, State built its case almost entirely on evidence, which included Cora's eyewitness identification, physical evidence, that tattoo ID, and Speck's behavior after the murders. All that kind of speaks for itself.
Can you imagine this case getting botched or thrown out because of the Miranda rights?
How many lives would be impacted? Wow. Well, not only did William Martin have the Miranda stuff to worry about, but he also had this, like, traumatized and very fragile survivor, Cora. And that's part of the reason I said he seems like such a good guy, because Martin was so careful with Cora. I think he like genuinely cared about her and wanted to protect her as best as he could. And he had a lot of factors working against him, obviously, like Cora's mental state, first and foremost.
Yeah, she was traumatized.
Yeah, well, he needed to keep her safe and as comfortable as possible because it was so important. Like, her testimony was so important to nailing the monster that is Richard Speck.
Mm-hmm.
And Martin was also concerned about the press getting to Cora. And this is something that I never even thought about, but she was worried that the government in the Philippines would attempt to interfere and just bring her home to get her out of this mess, which I didn't even consider until reading that part.
Mm-hmm.
So to ensure Cora's safety, she was basically hidden in an apartment in the city with someone that had eyes on her 24/7. And the book states that Martin treated Cora with kid gloves. But I feel like it's more like he treated her with respect, like kindness and genuine concern.
Yeah, I agree.
This is wild. They had Cora come to the hospital and she's dressed as a nurse. She's in her uniform and she walks in with another nurse as like a little ploy to make it look like these are two nurses just doing their nursely duties and doing their little rounds of patient checks. But in reality, she was there to ID Richard. Wow. And when she gets to his room, she looks at him and he was sedated. Thank God.
Yeah.
But she looks at Richard, walks back to William Martin and says, quote, "It's really him," end quote. And then she immediately passes out.
Oh, I can't even begin to fathom what she is going through.
Right. Well, we talked in previous episodes about what it would be like to find your friend or family member murdered. But these were eight of your friends, like not to mention having to hide from this maniac while it was happening. Good God. So while the prosecution had all of the evidence we just talked about, they also had semen. And we're not talking about little men on a boat. So remember, this is 1966, though, decades before DNA was discovered. It wasn't even a thing. However, they were doing blood typing at the time, though, and they could determine whether or not Richard Speck was a secretor. Do you know what that is?
Barf.
It's not
sounds
like a,
gross.
You talk about pervs. We're not talking about actual secretions. It's like your blood's, I think it's ABO antigens. They're present. They're also present in your tears, your sweat, your saliva. That means you secrete your antigens into your other fluids.
I don't like the word secrete.
I know. It's like moist.
Stop.
So it was, but it was definitely not like a smoking gun or anything as conclusive as DNA, but it did help kind of in conjunction with everything. We've heard circumstantial cases before. Mountains of circumstantial evidence kind of equal one big piece of physical. Like it adds up. So even though William Martin was ready to take Richard Speck down, it was not easy. Like his defense attorney was brutal and used every dirty tactic in the book to like delay the proceedings, get evidence withheld. He even petitioned for a change in venue, stating that Richard couldn't receive a fair trial in Chicago, which I get. I don't like it, but I get it. There was no way. And the defense attorney, whose name was Gerald Getty, by the way, he also tried to convince a judge that each victim needed their own trial. And at each trial, they wouldn't be allowed to talk about the other murders.
Yeah, I don't really understand that. Like, I guess I still don't. Would that have meant that at each trial, they would only act like one murder had occurred?
Correct. And that's, but apparently they didn't have any basis for it because it didn't happen. But yeah, that was the hope, so that you couldn't talk about what an unhinged maniac he is. This was eight isolated incidents.
Wow.
Well, Getty was successful in a lot of his antics, including getting the evidence of the gun thrown out. Like he argued it was illegally seized. He also tried to argue the fingerprints. And the big reason he could do that was because of that damn reporter who just moseyed on through the crime scene. And there was also the matter of Richard's sanity. Like he was examined and spoken to by several quote-unquote experts. And I mean, they were experts in the sense that they were licensed psychiatrists, but sometimes, you know how we throw the word expert around, you actually have to prove that you're an expert witness in part of the trial.
Yeah.
So they use it pretty loosely is all I'm getting at. And while the majority of the doctors believed that Richard was indeed a sociopath, they all believed he was sane and could move forward with the trial, which began on April 3rd, 1967. And I think we messed up by not including Cora in our girl power block back in July. Because this woman, she stood at like 4'10". She was this tiny little thing. She walks up to this witness stand like she is 7 feet tall. And Cora bravely and confidently tells the entire courtroom about the night that Richard Speck maliciously massacred 8 beautiful, incredible young nurses. So Cora told the court how he systematically led each girl one by one out of that room and to their death.
Oh, God.
And the entire courtroom just sat there like with their jaws dropped because Cora talked about how these women were just so scared of Richard that they mostly stayed quiet, but occasionally Cora could hear like their muffled cries for help as they took their last breath.
Wow.
She talked about how she could hear the running water, like each time he was washing his hands, and that meant she knew another girl had been killed and he was coming for another one of them. And then as if Cora wasn't already a freaking Wonder Woman, she gets down from the witness box and she looks directly at Richard Speck. And pointed to his face and said, quote, "This is the man."
Wow. So, that's amazing.
Badass.
Yeah.
Well, the jury took 49 minutes to find Richard Speck guilty, and he was ultimately sentenced to death.
Which is exactly what he deserved.
The least of what he deserves. Well, but we know that didn't happen. So in 1971, an appeal was granted because there was supposedly some drama with the jury. So the court was like, all right, well, first of all, Richard Speck is guilty. That's not the question we have here. But the issue is apparently jurors who were opposed to capital punishment, they weren't included in the jury. So the sentencing process was ruled unconstitutional. So then in 1972, the U.S. Supreme Court rules that the way the death penalty was being used was unconstitutional.
Strongly disagree, but okay.
Same girl. Well, because of that, the state had to resentence Richard Speck, and he was given 400 to 1,200 years in life. I never understood that. Like, I mean, I get either. It, but it's like, you're sentenced to 1 bajillion years.
Oh, my God.
Well, he filed many unsuccessful appeals over the years, but he remained in prison. And eventually, Richard Speck passed away on December 5th, 1991, just one day before his 50th birthday, and it determined he had a heart attack. And no one wanted to claim his ashes.
Understandable.
Gene was probably like, oh, I gotta get his ashes.
Exactly. They're like, no, thank you.
Well, let's talk about our courageous survivor, Corazon. Cora. So after the trial, she returned to the Philippines, got a job as a nurse, and was elected to the town council in her hometown, and she got married. And eventually awesome. She and her husband moved back to the United States as she thought it was a safer place to raise a family than her homeland. Think about that.
Yeah, that's wild.
You know, in one of the few statements that she gave later in life, she told Nina Schmale's brother, John, that she had never forgotten Nina's kindness and still missed her.
Aww.
So I wish we could end on that, but there are two more insane topics that we cannot, if we're talking about Richard Speck, we need to talk about these things.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you may have heard of Richard Speck being referred to as the Birdman over the years. And mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you why, but quick trigger warning to animal cruelty. So if you're not, if you don't want to hear this, 30 seconds.
Skip ahead.
Yep. So apparently Richard either found an injured sparrow or somehow got it into the prison. And Richard decided to keep it as a pet. But one day the guards told him, they're like, you really shouldn't have that thing in here as a pet. And this is horrific, but according to sources, Richard Speck looked at the guard, picked up the bird, and threw it into a nearby fan. And the fan was on, mind you.
Oh, God.
And he again looked at the guard and said, quote, if I can't have it, no one can. And if that doesn't epitomize Richard Speck, I don't know what does.
You're right. Absolutely.
So the other thing when it comes to Speck is this tape. And I don't know if anybody saw Monster Ed Gein or just mm-hmm. have seen this tape on the internet, but it is so, I don't even know where to begin. So in 1996, we're talking 5 years after Richard's death, a news reporter who worked in Chicago, his name was Bill Curtis of Cold Case Files fame.
That's still, wild.
Still the narrator. If we have another season, I'm sure he will do it.
So, oh, wow.
But Bill receives this videotape from a still unnamed attorney. We don't know where it came from. So I'm not sure if some people know who sent this video or if it's like just still completely anonymous or how they came across it. But it's believed that the video was covertly shot in 1988. So Richard Speck is on camera. He's wearing silk panties, snorting off of what looks like a platter about this big, like snorting cocaine and performing sexual favors on other inmates. But this is the part that's so bizarre, off the wall, cuckoo bananas. So in addition to the drugs, he had somehow been taking hormones. I don't know where he was getting them, but he had gigantic cans. Like, this guy had full-on rack. And you can find this video online if you'd like. I'll put a picture of it. I do not recommend it unless you want to see Richard Speck's giant boobs.
Yeah, and then you have to bleach your freaking brain to get that out of it. Oh,
it's weird.
You watch it and you're like, what the hell did I just watch?
What did I just watch? Did that guy have boobs? Like, I can't figure it out. And I think the most troubling part of the video is that other inmate starts like interviewing Richard. He's asking him questions. So not only Richard did say he's having the time of his life in prison, but when the inmate asked Richard if he killed 8 young women, Richard replies, sure, I did. And then the inmate asks why. And Richard chuckles a bit and he says, quote, it just wasn't their night. End quote.
What you locked up for?
They count murder.
Did you kill him?
Sure I did.
Why?
Just one there night.
Did you have a gun on the night of the killing?
Yeah, always got it.
Oh, did you have the gun? Why you didn't use the gun? Why did you prefer to use the knife?
You don't make too much noise. And there's a no shape to run. And that's quiet. All I want to do is just burglar.
Yes, sir.
Start off as burglar. And all hell broke loose. That's how I was bad, just drugs. One of them stood on me in the face. Said she was going to pick me out of the lineup. I went off, hit her in the chest and that. And there was two more there, so I offed them. wound up trying to kill off all the women. Strangling in person?
Mm-hmm.
Did not like what you see on TV. Got 3 seconds and he's dead. Mm-hmm. Or you gotta go after about 3.5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a lot of strength.
How do you feel after putting those ladies?
Like how it felt. I had no feeling.
Well, that is the story of Richard Speck. I mean, that was, I know that was long, but hey, that's what it took. We needed to make sure we covered all the victims, and we did want to dive into the psychology.
And I think this was such an important case to cover because of so many things happening at the time. Like, people could not imagine some guy just walking into a home, committing a mass murder, and just leaving. Like, there's never a reason for murder. But this one was almost like he did it for fun. And imagine the people in the 60s. It's supposed to be this peace and love, and this happened? And then it's like just a couple years later, you have Charles Manson. So between Speck and Manson, it was like the end of innocence.
Absolutely. And oddly, Richard Speck, a lot of people think he's considered like the first mass murderer. And he is, to an extent, he's the first mass murderer of the 20th century. So things happened before him, but he kind of brought this idea of these mass killings into the, this is when there was an awakening going on.
That's so terrifying. And I think that people, the public's minds were just so blown by it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's horrific. It's as horrific as it gets. And the victims could not have been more innocent. They were just trying to live their life and do, that's the worst part. They were trying to do so much good in this world. Eight of them. You guys, is that a Christmas gift or what? What a way to make you smile around the holidays. Holy crap.
Well, hopefully you can like listen to this while you're wrapping gifts or getting whatever you need to get done.
Yeah.
So we hope everyone is having a wonderful holiday season. Get excited for the new year. We're excited. You know, our Patreon is going to drop in January. So we started putting some information out about that. But I guess that's all I got.
Yeah, that's good. This was a long one. So I think that's more important than banter was to get all this content in. But we hope you guys have a wonderful holiday. We got one more episode coming up on the 30th, I think it airs. And it's, man, after losing Tobias Jelinek, we had to come up with a replacement that rose to that level of guestdom.
And we think you're going to be pretty entertained.
The holiday spirit is going to be through the roof.
Well, on that note, until next time, stay safe, stay hydrated, and remember, perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
But they sometimes wear man boobs.
Oh my God, he's so weird.
He's disgusting. See ya. Merry Christmas.
Bye.